Hey, this is David Rovix coming to you wherever you are with another episode of Fifth Estate Live. We are broadcasting on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, as well as on my Facebook, LinkedIn, VK, Twitch, Twitter, and YouTube accounts. And all these broadcasts also go up as podcasts afterwards if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. And I'm broadcasting interviews with people usually 3 days a week, usually Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And then the last Saturday of every month, including this Saturday, I do a concert at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on these platforms. And Tuesday, it's Fifth Estate Live, which has an actual producer, which is Peter Werby in Detroit, Michigan, and actually in the suburbs of Detroit. And we are speaking today with somebody else who is almost an actual neighbor of Peter's, in fact, Frank Joyce, who is also, like Peter, a longtime organizer in the Detroit area, as well as author and journalist. And we're bringing Frank on the screen right now. Frank, great to have you.
Thanks
for the hour. Great to be here. And you've been most recently writing some commentary on the election that is a sort of ongoing process right now. And I know we only have an hour, and it's really like there's so much going on that just keeping track of it is just overwhelming, even for a news junkie like myself. Yeah. And I have a lot of sympathy for people out there who are not normally news junkies who are trying to keep track of what's happening, because it's overwhelming for anyone. But can you give us your sort of elevator pitch on the election, or some kind of analysis of what's going on? You think sure. you think in your recent piece that I just read, you were saying that basically the Biden's victory is a real sort of broad statement against Trumpism that 80 million people came out with, and you feel optimistic about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I should premise this by saying that, you know, throughout the whole arc of my political activism, which is many decades long now, I mostly have not been involved in electoral politics. A campaign here and there. I worked on a campaign for General Baker in state run when he ran for state representative in 1968, and a couple of others. But I've generally been in the camp of, well, real social change doesn't come from elections. And I still believe that, but I also did conclude that this election was something very different, and that it represented a kind of turning point opportunity because it was a values election in the same way that the election of 1860 was, that preceded the Civil War. And it was a referendum on Trumpism. And it did represent an opportunity to repudiate Trumpism. And so I'm really quite excited about the fact that 80 million people did turn out and were organized to turn out, because I have never seen grassroots organizing like I saw in this election. I don't know a single person who didn't knock on a door or send a postcard or make some phone calls or move to another state to work on the election. It really did engage the population. Trump's side did too, by the way, as we could see on TV every night and can still see on TV every night. I mean, Trump's defenders are a passionate and enthusiastic lot, and we are still going to be dealing with that for a long time to come. But I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that 6 million more people voted against Trump than voted for him in a really large turnout. There are a lot of moving parts to why and how that happened, I think. But what I'm advocating is that going forward, we understand that we are operating from a certain position of strength, and that being 80 million strong is a very broad, it may only be an inch deep, but it's a very broad platform in which to advocate for more transformative social change. So that's my elevator take.
And when you say it's only an inch deep, I think that's a really good way to put it, because when you're talking about an election between two parties, then it makes it really difficult to really have any kind of completely believable analysis of why people voted one way or the other, because there's so many possible reasons why someone would vote for one or the other side when there's only two parties, right? Can you talk about why? I mean, I know you've already just talked about it a little bit, but talk more about why you actually think that this is a referendum of any kind, either pro or against Trump, pro Biden, when there's only two options to sort of analyze in terms of why people voted one way or the other.
Well, interestingly enough, the fact that I take your point exactly about how, guess what, the system is rigged, and the fact that there are only two choices fundamentally is evidence of that. But the flip of that in 2020, at any rate, is that narrowing it down to two choices makes it crystal clear in a way that would not otherwise be the case. One of the things that happened that was fascinating to me is that the role of third parties, which was significant in the 2016 election, was not very significant in the 2020 election. And that in and of itself represented a decision on the part of a lot of people who might otherwise be inclined to support the Green Party, for example, or libertarians, or one of the third parties said, no, there may be elections where that makes sense, but this is not that election. This is an election that prevents a very stark choice. And of course, many of us, and I wrote a lot of things before 2016 about what I thought Trump represented then. But once that election was over, it was easy to attribute it to, well, people didn't know this, or there were some fluke factors involved as to why Trump won the Electoral College being one obvious example of that. But there were no illusions of that sort, or let's just say virtually no illusions of that sort available in 2020. Everybody knew what Trumpism represented. My saying in 2016 was Trump is the mosquito, not the disease. But I think understanding at different levels for different people that was true, that Trump was representative of the colonial assumptions of U.S. society in 2020, of white male property owner power, was just an inescapable fact that people had to come to a conclusion about one way or the other. Some people I know are quite down in the dumps about the election, and they're very depressed about the fact that 74 million people voted for Trump, which was even more people than did in 2016. And my response to that is, well, and this may sound a little condescending, I don't mean it that way, but well, what that tells me is you didn't really ever understand how deeply entrenched white supremacy is in our society in the first place. Because if you did understand that, you would not be surprised at how deep, more than an inch deep, way more than an inch deep, and how broad what I call the white way of thinking is, and how it has become, I use the metric, 28 generations now into the colonial white male property owner supremacist way of thinking. Of course, that's deeply entrenched. And of course, it will take more than one generation to get it down to a more manageable size. But I come back to the fact that I think this election could well be seen as a turning point in that process. And I'll just add a little PS to that. I want to get to some conversation about the pandemic, I hope, here in a minute. But one of the things that I think makes the election so significant this time around is to reiterate the clarity of the choice that people had in front of them.
Mm-hmm. And so, but as to that clarity, I mean, you know, it's easy to see from one angle, you know, for many angles, that there's this clarity between the two choices. But also there's equally, I think it's just as easy to see a lack of clarity, because I mean, with Trump's supporters, how many of them were people that would necessarily have even voted for a mainstream Republican prior to voting for Trump? You know, I think a lot of, I mean, at least, you know, I don't know statistically how it bears out, but I know there were quite a few people. I think a fairly significant number who voted both for Obama and for Trump.
Right.
And yeah. So, you know, this is like, I mean, there was one thing I read about how it was the easiest way to predict who voted for Trump was whether you lost income over the past 10 years.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I have another saying that applies to the election, although it's more broad than that. And the saying is, the turbulence you are experiencing is caused by the flapping wings of the chickens coming home to roost. And what I mean by that, in part, as it applies to particularly to people who voted first for Obama and then for Trump, is that a lot of the promises of white supremacy and of, I don't like the term white privilege, but you know, and has some common sense value. But a lot of what white people thought they were entitled to, the classic Macomb County Reagan Democrat white voter, for example, began to crumble. And loss of income is one example of that. The massive number of deaths caused by the opioid crisis is another. The deterioration of the climate as manifest by everything from wildfires in California to, I mean, Midland, Michigan, as iconic white community from which the chemical Agent Orange came from the Dow chemical facilities in Midland, Michigan, was devastated by a flood caused by a dam that burst. So all of a sudden, white people are having to wrestle with something that their parents didn't. If your parents came of age in the post-World War II period, you were, you know, it's funny, Trump rode that escalator down, but my parents rode that escalator up. They were early white flighters from Detroit who fell for the siren call of the suburbs and of a brand new house and of cars and television sets and ultimately iPhones and all of that. But here we are with masses of people, admittedly some voted for Biden, some voted for Trump, but as you point out, masses of people who are experiencing one kind or another of a decline in the quality of their life. So does that make them is that destabilizing? Let's use that terminology. You're damn right that's destabilizing. It is the collapse of a world order in which the United States prevailed in World War II and had this sort of golden age of global domination and of trade unions that were still considered legitimate and strong and that gave white workers a stake in the economy and a capacity to influence the economy through collective bargaining and union organizing and so on, all gone now. And so one thing I don't think, let me be clear about this, while I celebrate the outcome of this election, I don't think that it represents anything at all in a restabilizing of the crisis of capitalism of the 20th century. Now, I know that a lot of people see that in Joe Biden, and they hope for that. And they say,
look at his cabinet appointment.
All these Obama picks for his cabinet, and so things are going to go back to the way they were. No, they aren't.
But even if they did, I mean, this would be going back to terrible instability. I mean, during Obama's 8 years in power, my rent doubled, and that happened to people all over this country. I mean, the average African-American experienced I think, 53% increase in the cost of housing during Obama's 8 years in office. Housing happens to be something I'm especially focused on out here in the most rent-burdened city in the country, Portland, Oregon. But this is, Obama's time meant poverty for a whole lot of people, you know. So, and if Biden goes back to these neoliberal policies, then it seems, which it seems obviously he's going to do, then we're going to be going back to economic instability, and who knows what kind of foreign policies. It's another question, but we'll be going right back to instability, which was the delivery system for Trump in the first place, it seems to me. I mean, of course, there's the 28 generations of white supremacy, which is, you know, obviously extremely important factor that led to Trump. But it seems like, at least when we look at the history of many different countries over the past century, one consistent pattern, whether you're talking about recently in Brazil or the 1920s in Italy or the 1930s in Germany, is social democrats that fail to provide for the public welfare get replaced by fascists who claim that they're going to do that better. And the only reason the fascists are able to claim they'll do it better is because there's no viable left that's actually doing what the left is supposed to be doing. Right. Right.
Yeah,
exactly. And now we're going to go back to another unviable so-called left. I mean, what passes for left on CNN with the Democrats.
Yeah, one of the ways that I think that this the point you make comes together is that Obama, I think, made the erroneous assumption that he could, for example, one of his first decisions in his first term, of course, was to try to solve the economic crisis of that time by supporting Wall Street at the expense of the rest of the economy.
That was the great failure of his administration, it seems to me.
Yes.
If you're going to pick one.
If you're going to pick one. But I think there's a corollary to that, because race is always in the mix, and from my point of view, rarely gets the amount of attention that it deserves. I think he also thought that white people would be okay with him if he didn't do anything for the white working class, as long as he didn't do anything for blacks either. And so he sent all these symbolic messages, inviting the cop and Henry Louis Gates to have a beer at the White House. And he tried to reassure white people that he wasn't going to do anything to rock the boat of the advantages that whites have over blacks. And so, as you point out, even more dramatic during the Obama 8 years was the shift of how much wealth black households lost, largely related to the housing market, but for other factors as well. So this idea that I won't annoy white people because I will go out of my way to reassure them I'm not doing anything to help black people, created the very conditions that you're describing that also obtained in Italy in the 1920s and that we have seen elsewhere. I bring that back, though, to shame on us if we don't sense the opportunity in this moment to advocate for more transformative change, which I realize is a kind of a fuzzy phrase, but and we can maybe get into that. But also, I reiterate the instability that is just built into where the entire planet finds itself at this point. I've been writing for years about what I call the six existential threats. On a good day, I can remember at least five of them. So we'll see if it comes up how we do here. But one of the threats that I wrote about starting quite a few years ago which, to be honest, I would have put at the bottom of the list, was pandemics. And I think one of the other reasons that Trump lost, to state an obvious point that isn't made very often, was the pandemic. And his indifference to it and his indifference to the suffering that it caused and his inability to formulate any response to reply to it.
His inability to show empathy, wasn't it? That's kind of a sociopathic kind of inability to show empathy, which at a time like this, like, you got to at least be able to fake it. And he can't even do that, it seems.
Yeah, but that brings us back to the 28 generations, because, you know, white supremacy is sociopathic. In a very broad and collective way. If you can be indifferent to genocide against indigenous people and indifferent to slavery and indifferent to the efforts of slaves to rebel against their condition repeatedly and to resist slavery, you are sowing the seeds that, again, are chickens now coming home to roost. Because Trump, in that sense, is just sort of the ultimate expression of these core colonial ideas that either we're going to figure out a way to get past, or the existential threats are going to accelerate to the possible point of extinction.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about why you... You were saying that you're not a fan of the term white privilege, and you prefer the term white supremacy. And I think, as much as that might to some people seem like a really minor point, for other people it's absolutely all consuming. And can you just give us a little on that?
How many angels can dance on the head of that pin anyway?
Yeah.
Well, the distinction I make is this. I start with this. One of the problems with talking, let me back up one step. What I'm known for, if I'm known for anything, you know, to more than 11 people on the universe, is having a focus on issues of race and of the importance. Early on in the 1960s, when the question came up, what should white people do? I was one of the white people who said white people should focus on the white community. That if the problem of white supremacy originates with white people and is perpetuated by white people, if you want to do something about it, that's a good place to do it. And so I have had that perspective for more than 50 years in a lot of organizational and writing activity and so on around that. So from that point of view, one of my concerns is this kind of common sense communication point. If you tell white people over and over and over again that they're privileged, the most common and sensible response to make to that is, well, thanks for pointing that out. How do I keep it? And I think that that's a part of what's happened, right? I think a part of what's referred to as the Trump base is about, if I can't have my all-white suburb and my all-white public schools for my children and my all-white church, who am I? What am I? What will become of me? There is this great fear of the unknown. And part of that is fueled by the conversations that well-meaning people, me included, have had with white people over the years, among other problems, doesn't talk to white people about what white supremacy costs white people. I'll give you a very concrete example of this. This is something that, I'm writing this book about this. So this is something that's in my book.
In a book that you're working on now.
The book I'm working on now, right. Mm-hmm. And one of the chapters talks about a concept that I call lockdown zero. And the concept of lockdown zero refers to the fact that if you look at the history of, this is a point I took from Reverend Barber, by the way, I want to give credit where credit is due. Consider the fact that it has taken 400 years for the minimum, the federal minimum wage to go from zero to $7.25 an hour. That is a really tiny, really slow incremental change. All right, wrap your head around that idea and turn it upside down. So one of the things I have in my book, because there's a workbook section and there's the Memefisto section. But in the workbook section is a proposed leaflet, and it says something like this. Memo to white workers. If you want to know how high or low your wage will be, there's a simple way to find out. Look up in your state, what is the average wage for a black worker? And whatever that wage is will tell you how high your wage is going to be. Because in an economy that started based on slavery, the whole wage structure that has evolved from that is like having to walk around carrying, you know, with a 400-pound barbell on your back. It's just designed to give so much power to capital and so little power to workers that people never ask the question, why is it so damn hard to get anything, to get health care, to get Social Security, to get an increase in the minimum wage, to get a union, to get anything? Well, go back to where we started. And once you do that, it's my hope is, and I have some anecdotal experience that supports this proposition, it's kind of liberating. You can look at the relationship, be it economic, be it social, be it by any metric, between whites and blacks, and begin as a white person to say, you know what, this sucks. This is like not working for anybody. Sure, I hear a lot of propaganda about all the advantages I have. But I'm still $75,000 behind on my student loans. I still can't afford to pay my rent. I still may get the pandemic and I don't have health care. It's all about trying to think of ways to reframe this whole conversation. And back to the actual question, I do remember it. White privilege doesn't help us do that. I think it does more harm than good.
Because basically,
they don't have advantages. They do, but right. That's just not the best place to engage the conversation.
Advantages is relative, and then it's also advantages that are predicated on disadvantages, right? I mean, divide and conquer has worked in this society, and divide and conquer has caused a working class that is overall much more impoverished than it would be in a society that isn't divided by race like that. And this has also impoverished white people as well, relative to their counterparts in other industrialized societies that don't have this kind of history, right? Like when we look to Europe, where I spend much of my time when I'm working, touring, playing music, before the pandemic, it's really obvious that these societies, these multi-party democracies that don't spend all their money on the military and don't have the same kind of history of this terrible division of slavery, they have achieved a far greater degree of equality.
And they would have even more, but for their own role in colonialism and in the seizing of territory from Africa to what we call North and South America and so on and so forth. But again, the idea is we need concepts that are liberating, that open our minds and that expand our sense of what our opportunities are, not keep us confined in these, to go back to an old electoral term, Tweedledum, Tweedledee choices. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of that happening. And ironically, even the pandemic is sending a message that I don't think has really started to register yet. And that's not surprising for any number of reasons. But part of the ideology of what I call the white way of thinking is the idea of human supremacy, and that we as white people have really strange relationships with one another as Homo sapiens, in part because our relationship with trees and forests and elephants and coral reefs is also completely out of whack. And we have this notion of which, you know, the book of Genesis is one example, that God put us here to have dominion over all of the other life forms. Well, thank goodness, indigenous people, and this is one of the reasons for the clash of civilizations that colonialism represents, indigenous people never had that sense of being out of harmony with other life forms in the way that white people do. But the pandemic is a wake-up call. The pandemic is, yo, dude. And we're seeing this play out in Thanksgiving travel. And it's a battle, by the way. And I'm not saying the outcome is certain, because I don't think the outcome is certain at all. But it's this battle of, well, I can do whatever I want. I can wear a mask or not wear a mask. I can travel on Thanksgiving weekend. I can have 15 people over for Thanksgiving dinner, et cetera, because a vaccine will come and save us somehow.
Maybe in a few months after a few hundred thousand people die, then that's the best case.
Right.
And, exactly. And people are willing to risk that, I guess.
Well, but again, that's how we've been trained. And so this notion I have of the unlearning of white supremacy, for example, or untraining people in the white way of thinking is what I'm trying to talk about in this book that I'm working on now. And oh, by the way, can we talk about the book that I already worked on?
Yeah, I was just going to, the one about Vietnam, right? The one about Vietnam?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think there's a lot of things that come to mind relative to your long years in anti-war organizing. The situation that we're in now with the election also reminds me very much of the situation in the late 60s. I mean, like with, you know, people had such hope in Johnson and President Johnson in terms of his Great Society program and talking his background as a acolyte of FDR and a big fan of the New Deal. And, you know, a lot of hope in terms of progressive uplift of working class kind of policies. And then, of course, the reality more was characterized by napalm and air raids and millions of people being killed in Vietnam. And and then similarly, you know, now with Biden, as with Obama, as with Bill Clinton, there's people, particularly with Biden, I think perhaps more than ever, there's people hoping that during the pandemic, with all these inequities being so starkly exposed by the pandemic and that everything else, that Biden is going to rise to the occasion and implement the kind of Great Society programs that people hoped Johnson would implement in a much bigger way. And then are they going to, is that going to happen, or are we going to see more bombs falling on some nation full of people of color who are going to die with their skin catching on fire?
Well, let me respond to that, David, in two ways. One is just to make a very sharp contrast between how Vietnam has dealt with the pandemic and how the United States has dealt.
Yes.
Because Vietnam and New Zealand are kind of the poster children for here's the right way to do this.
And Cuba.
And the right way to do it, among other things, involves a degree of social cohesion and a degree of, you know, I have another of my lines is, well, our national culture, we're told, is all about rugged individualism. But actually, it's about rugged selfishness. And we are seeing the wages of selfishness play out in the 250,000 deaths number and climbing to a much higher number. If we fixed everything starting tomorrow, that number is still going to be colossal. So again, let's look at some different ways that societies organize themselves,
right,
and how they collectively respond to challenges and existential threats that are going to be coming, whether from pandemics, whether from nuclear catastrophes, whether from economic catastrophes or whatever.
But the thing about the pandemic is the immediacy of it, right? I mean, when we're talking about the economics or the climate change, it's always something in the future. Absolutely. It's something you can somehow put off. You can loan a bank another $1 trillion.
And pandemic is right here, right now.
It's exponential. It's here. It's now, and no fantasy con man can make it go away.
Well, and the same with wildfires in California, for example.
That too, right?
Also,
very immediate.
But where I want to connect some dots here, the title of the book is The People Make the Peace, Lessons from the Vietnam Anti-War Movement. And one of the things that's in the conversation now, I think in fascinating ways, and that I'm working with a lot of people to put in the conversation in 2021, is emphasized by Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech on April 4th, 1967. Where for the first time, he brought together in a highly visible way, he had talked about it before, but in that speech at the Riverside Church, when he talked about the triple evils of militarism, materialism, and racism, and connected domestic politics to the war in Vietnam, that was a turning point, I believe, in the 1960s. And because why? Because among other things, that produced his split from Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson jumped on the bandwagon of the voter rights movement and of the dismantling of Jim Crow and saw himself in FDR terms, in terms of domestic issues. But he couldn't escape the colonialism of the continued war on Vietnam. And then when Martin Luther King said, just a minute, these things are connected, of course, that produced an enormous backlash against Dr. King that 1 year later to the day put him in the ranks of the many political assassinations throughout U.S. history. Another thing we're not permitted to talk about. But so the challenge for Biden is going to be far more for people like us and people like whoever's watching now, is going to be far more around what are called foreign policy questions than domestic issues. Biden's going to do some things on domestic issues. He's going to do some things to shore up healthcare and to respond to the pandemic and so on and so forth. But what we are seeing in his cabinet as it is being rolled out already is more of the same when it comes to the attempt of colonial hegemony on the planet Earth, which is a recipe for catastrophe, which is a recipe for existential threats. So commercial message here, stay tuned for organizing efforts around April 4th, 2021, of encouraging people to go to places like military bases and police stations and maybe even shopping centers, and do public readings of Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech. Because 50 some odd years later, it's all still in there. And that still is a way we hope to overcome some of the problems that we face as a movement that people, I don't like this cliche, but it works, that people are siloed. They think it's either police issues, or they think it's healthcare, or they think it's one thing or another. But of course, all of these things derive from the same system in the same way.
And also back in the 60s, it was, and I think really well through into the 70s, as I recall, it was very common to use the term the movement to encompass what we would now consider to be a multitude of movements or a movement of movements, to use Naomi Klein's term. But back then it was just the movement encompassed a lot of things, right?
Yep.
So you guys are, whoever is watching or listening, you are tuned to Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance and Cable Community Radio, among other places, every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. It's produced by Peter Werby of the Fifth Estate Editorial Collective, and you can go to fifthestate.org and subscribe to the quarterly print magazine and read articles and check out other past episodes of Fifth Estate Live as well. And we're talking with author, journalist, and organizer from Detroit area, Frank Joyce. And so every year we have Democrats and Republicans coming together to support the biggest military budget in the history of the world. Every year, it's a new one. Biggest ever. and in the last military budget, I believe there were 100 dissenters, mostly Democrats. And somebody said, "Yeah, that's the party. That's the element of the Congress that is not part of the war party." As he put the coalition of Republicans and Democrats that are the 435 that voted in favor of the military budget right. out of the 535. But this is, yeah, and as somebody, in fact, Peter was pointing out on one of the comments on Twitch, we have, you know, our military is surrounding Russia. I noticed that that in many of Biden's speeches, maybe it's only noticeable because it's not how Trump usually ends his speeches, but in many of Biden's speeches, he ends with "God bless our troops," which is just quite a way for a president of a country during a pandemic to address the American people. It just seems like "God bless our troops." I mean, there's a lot of things you can end a speech with, but "God bless our troops," well, that certainly is one of them, but it might indicate a certain kind of orientation.
I think it indicates continued adherence to what I'm learning more about every day from some of my indigenous friends of the depth of the culture of violence in the United States and the degree to which, for example, when people talk about defund the police, unless someone works to bring it up, that's often not connected to, say, defund the Pentagon, which I refer to as the fourth branch of the United States government. But we are so invested in militarism and so invested in violence as the first response to anything. And one of the most common manifestations of that is worship of the troops and of all of the attention that gets paid and the deference that is paid to the military and to soldiers and so on. And that's why, again, for me, Dr. King's speech on April 4th, because it included militarism and because it represented a deviation from that worship, and it really is worship. I mean, it is like faith-based. And the example you gave, David, of Biden, you know, ending his speeches that way is one of, when you start to look for this, you begin to see every single day how much homage is paid to military, to guns, to weaponry, to defense budgets, whether it be for police departments or for the Pentagon. This is so integral to the white way of thinking that breaking out of the white way of thinking prison requires breaking out of that obedience to there's a military solution to everything.
Mm. There you know, is. When you talk about the idea of people going around and reciting Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech from April 4th, 67, the Beyond Vietnam speech, it's a wonderful idea. It makes me think about the kind of organizing that was going on around the Vietnam War and opposition to it. And I hear a lot of people talking about since the end of May and since the uprisings have been going on after the killing of George Floyd, I've heard a lot of people talking about, including on, all over the media, about how this is the biggest movement they've ever seen and all this kind of stuff. And I don't know where they're getting this, you know, from, because I mean, there's been a lot of good sized protests, and it's, and what's been notable is the spontaneity of it and the mass participation and the fact that it's just like, you hear a news story and you get out and you hit the streets and you go to wherever you think a protest should be happening. And then there's like 10 different protests happening in town because lots of people had 10 different ideas of where they should go. And, you know,
and they all showed up on social media. So that's why they all went there.
Yeah, right. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And then people, yeah, all these, I've never seen so many protests that were called on Facebook that didn't actually happen, but that, but that had so many people driving around the block looking for the protest, you know, like, okay, the protest is where, you know, you have to get out of your car and, you know, okay. But like during the, especially by the later stage, by the late 60s, every military base in the world, every U.S. military base had an anti-war cafe. And I know that every U.S. military base in the United States, and certainly if not all of them around the world, most of them, it's certainly in places like Germany and Japan, there was an anti-war coffee house located like across from the gate or right down the block, staffed by anti-war activists, many of them veterans, and they were the backbone of this movement, which was on the ground everywhere, and that kind of level of organization, and like the distribution of the Black Panthers Party paper on military bases around the country and around Vietnam was massive, and the number of you could find stacks of them pretty much everywhere, right? And right, and the amount of effort that went into producing that many papers, and I mean, just the whole level of organization, I think it's worth noting, because it's easy for people to get caught up in Facebook and think that, you know, that they know how to organize. And I think there's a lot of really bad organizing going on.
Well, one of the things that, to do another plug here, that is a point we try to make in the book, The People Make the Peace, Lessons from the Vietnam Anti-War Movement, is that it's no accident that the anti-war movement, which was quantitatively at any rate by far bigger than what we call the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the student movement, et cetera, is, to coin a phrase, canceled from history, is a reflection in and of itself of how important it is to the Pentagon and other powers that be to diminish and marginalize just how big and powerful and deep and creative the anti-war movement was. And one of the groups I work with is called the Vietnam Peace Commemoration Committee. And we were founded in 2014 to focus on exactly that issue of trying to prevent the anti-war movement from being disappeared. Yeah. And we've done a number of webinars recently. And by the way, vietnampeace.org is the place to go find out more about past and future activities that we're involved with. But on one of our recent webinars that we just did about the Chicago conspiracy trial, the moderator of that webinar, John McAuliffe, pointed out that he, in 2020, both Elizabeth Warren and Barack Obama gave speeches paying tribute to the movements of the 60s. And in both cases, they didn't mention the anti-war movement.
Amazing.
And this is not an accident. You know, there's a Congress, part of the reason we came to exist is that Congress appropriated money in 2008, I believe, for a special division. This is funding outside of the regular military budget. There's a division of the Pentagon that is funded to tell the story of the Vietnam War in sanitized and favorable terms. And guess what? There's not much in there about the anti-war movement. If you go to their, and they organize events, many of them, by the way, associated with sports events, and mostly associated with football, to commemorate Vietnam veterans and to try and rehabilitate the reputation of the war and, as I say, marginalize the existence of the anti-war movement. And this is one of the biggest challenges I think we will face in the Biden administration. is around these issues of militarism and foreign policy. Because even we who think of ourselves as progressives or whatever we think of ourselves as tend not to pay enough attention to this and not to pay enough attention to the depth of the culture of violence because it is so immersive and because it is so much part of the culture.
You mentioned us progressives, and I'm curious about, like, you know, this term and the way that people understand the term or even the idea of being progressive these days. I mean, like, I think it's worth kind of a little bit of an exploration here. Like, the way that the Democratic Party gets painted as progressive when, like, it's unclear what that means, you know, because if you support free trade deals and that are clearly immiserating the working class and, right. Profiting the plutocracy, and you support, imperial foreign policies and $700 billion military budgets that kill working class people all over the world. I mean, this idea that you're progressive is just kind of, you know, it seems to mean that you support some kind of vague notion of intersectionality, and you support the rights of marginalized people, whatever that means. Because, of course, by marginalized people, you're not talking about the working class. You're not talking about people that are burdened by their inability to pay rent from whether they're white cis males or from an oppressed group, or rather they're from a racialized group. I mean, it's like whoever it is we're talking about, really a massive problem for the working class of this country and of the world. And the Democrats are nowhere to be seen when it comes to actually supporting.
Well, this comes back to exactly where you started this conversation, David. What we do have in the two political parties are competing, both of which are competing visions for how to make America great again. Neither of them are competing visions for how to make, and to use Vincent Harding's phrase, but you know, Vincent famously said, "I'm a citizen of a nation that does not yet exist." Well, there's problems with nation and citizenship, but set that aside for the moment. The concept that are we about building something new, or are we about retrieving something we think we once had, is another way to make a fundamental divide in what it is we're here to talk about. By the way, I saw Peter or you or somebody put VietnamPeace.org up on the screen. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah, I did that.
Okay, well, I want to promote another group that I work with, which is called NationalCouncilOfElders.org, the words, NationalCouncilOfElders.org. Mm-hmm. We've just relaunched our website, and that, too, is, I think, a helpful resource to go and look for, because our purpose, in part, involves being in dialogue with younger generations of activists and so on. So,
yeah, like people who might not know that there was an anti-war coffee house at the across from every military base in the country. Like, I mean, I think these kinds of little bits of information about how things were or could be it seems helpful in cutting through. Helpful.
It is helpful. Good. And don't underestimate, by the way, as important as those coffee houses were and so on. But what preceded the military resistance, of course, was resistance to the draft. And one of the things that I think we can pay more attention to than we do is, you know, we operate now in this mythology that we have a volunteer army. No, we don't. We have a recruited army. A huge portion of the Pentagon budget is devoted to military recruiting. And why? Because if it really was a volunteer army, there wouldn't be anywhere near enough people who would join it. Even in very adverse economic circumstances, people would not do that. People don't actually want that much to go to Afghanistan or Vietnam and kill people. They just don't. And they recognize that in so doing, they will suffer the kind of moral injuries that produces the astronomical military suicide rate, for example, and an astronomical military homicide rate. And if we were to devote the same attention to disrupting recruiting in schools and in other settings that we did to resisting the draft, it would make a really big difference.
And can you, in terms of that kind of organizing, I mean, there's any number of places to go in terms of talking about that. And but one thing as a musician that I think is worth mentioning is the anti-war movement employed the use of culture to communicate very, very successfully. And it's really, there's a lot of examples of social movements that have used culture very successfully to communicate and educate and win hearts and minds. But I think the anti-war movement is a key example. And there's a lot of examples of movements that have not done that and are not doing that well. But it's also worth mentioning how much the military employs culture to try to win hearts and minds in terms of, like, in Hollywood, in terms of music, in their advertising, in the budget of the military bands, which is bigger than the National Endowment for the Arts.
And in sports. Notice how many sports events. One of the things that, okay, so I'll make a little confession here. I play the game of golf. There's a long backstory to how that came to be, but never mind that. But one of the things that...
Is there like an anti-racist golfing association? There may be. There should be.
Yes. But what there is, of course, is that the existing golfing association, the PGA, like the NFL, has all these deals with the Pentagon. So many golf tournaments, if you watch golf tournaments on TV, on the 18th hole, it's not at all uncommon that, you know, the golfers show up for the grand finale, and there's a Marine, and there's somebody from the Coast Guard, and there's somebody from the Army in their flags and all their regalia. This association of militarism and sports is another aspect that is very deeply embedded into the culture of violence of this society. But I want to swing back, David, also to, you know, there's a lot of argument out there now about this new movie, The Chicago 7 by Aaron Sorkin. And I've been involved in the webinars and a lot of conversations about that. One of the things that I don't like about the movie, which raises valid points, especially for younger people, it's by a score of 51 to 49, I think probably a net plus that it's out there. But one of the things that it does is that it makes the yippie part of the Chicago demonstrations and trial and the political part of the Chicago demonstrations and trial more oppositional than they were. Because you're right. It was the combination. This was true in the Southern movement, too, right? From the SNCC Freedom Singers and Harry Belafonte and across the board, that successful, no music, no movement. Successful movements combine the mind, the heart, the spirit, the left brain and the right brain, culture and politics, because that's how Homo sapiens operate. Yeah. We're not just political, and we're not just musical, and we're not just athletic. We're all of those things.
Yeah.
And that's what our movements need to be.
And you were there in Chicago during the trial.
I was there. I was very active involved in planning the demonstrations and active in the demonstrations. And then kind of as a byproduct of that, I also worked on the staff of the trial itself. I'll tell a little anecdote that's come up in this recent discussion. I think maybe the single most awful thing that Aaron Sorkin does in his movie about the Chicago trial is he has a scene in which Dave Dellinger, who was an iconic pacifist who went to jail during World War II for crying out loud for resisting the draft in World War II, Sorkin has him in the trial hitting a U.S. Marshal. Dave Dellinger never hit anybody in his life. He was true to his values. And that undermining of the legitimacy of the idea of nonviolence and pacifism, to me, goes well beyond poetic license and out-and-out disinformation. But my story, I have a particular standing to address that issue because, and you can read the transcript, I'm the only person who, during the trial of the Chicago conspiracy trial, did physically attack a marshal. And the way that came about is that this was towards the end of the trial, and we planned to create a deliberate disruption in the courtroom during the trial. And the theory behind it was that the marshals, the same ones who had gagged Bobby Seale, you know, weeks earlier, would overreact to our disruption, and the jury would see the exact point that we were trying to make about the police riot that was the Chicago demonstrations. Well, we were right. Our prediction came true, and the marshals did go berserk, and they did start wailing on people, and this is the description of other people, not me. But apparently, I jumped over about three rows of benches and landed on the back of a marshal who was beating up one of our other staff members in the middle of the courtroom, for which I was summarily hauled off to the Cook County Jail, where I spent, I don't know, 2 or 3 days. Why I was never charged with more serious offenses, I don't know, but the statute of limitations has run out.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about it now. But the trial, as were the demonstrations, were themselves not without tensions and friction and antagonism, but did bring together political and cultural elements in the form of the role of Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin in the trial, for example.
Phil Oakes sang at the trial as well. Were
Phil
you there
Oakes sang at the trial.
We meant to do another interview where we just spend an hour talking about the trial. I think that would be.
Well, there are a couple of webinars that the Vietnam Peace Commemoration Committee that I mentioned earlier have done on the trial, one of which features a 1987 HBO movie about the trial, which is much better than the more recent Aaron Sorkin movie about the trial. And that webinar, which we did just a week ago, less than that, features that filmmaker and includes Bobby Seale and other people from the staff and the defense team and other participants. So there's a lot of good material out there now about these movies. And it's helpful in getting kind of up to speed on then versus now questions. Yeah.
I remember a really good radio play, actually, that was done on the trial, but now I can't remember who did that or where people can find it, but it exists.
I can't either, but it's easier than ever, of course, to find these kinds of resources. Yeah. But yeah, there was a radio play, there was a stage production that I think the San Francisco Mime Troupe or somebody did a piece on the trial. But now this new movie has sort of brought all that back into public awareness.
Yeah. Frank Joyce, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for coming on.
We're done?
I don't know where the hour went, but the hour says that's what happens. Yeah. That's what happens every time. Yeah.
Well, thank you, David. And thank you, Peter. This has been great.
Yeah, it really has. And hope to talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And thank you, everybody out there, for spending the hour with Frank Joyce, author, organizer, and journalist from Detroit. Check out those websites that have been mentioned, National Council of Elders and VietnamPeace.org. I'll be back at this time tomorrow at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, to talk with Bill Derizowitz, author of the recent book, The Death of the Artist, which I'm really looking forward to talking with him about. A great book. And then Friday, do it again. And then Saturday, I'll be doing a concert here on the internet at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. And all the Fifth Estate Live episodes, you can once again find at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the print magazine, quarterly print magazine there. And you can find the podcasts, interviews in podcast form there on the website, as well as at if you look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts. All right. Thanks a lot. And remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors. Until tomorrow, talk to you.